This is BPN Radio, your 24-hour internet prayer station, calling America to pray. It's time now for the Christian War Room with your host, Michael Schonborn. Now, here's Michael.
Thanks, Dale, and welcome to the Christian War Room. We have got part two of the talk by Peter Saunders, Dr. Peter Saunders, on transgenderism. It's a big issue today. It's become really big over the last couple of years. And he's sort of delving in and giving us also the solution of what to do with this. So the last talk was all about what has happened, how did it go, why do we arrive where we are now, and this part now goes into what we should do and how we should deal with it, and the myth which are sold as truth. Okay, stay tuned here at the Christian War Room.
Then we have Judith Butler, an American philosopher and the founder of gender mainstreaming. She took Beauvoir's ideas a step further, and she denied the importance of any biological gender difference between men and women and worked for its deconstruction in society. Now, Butler is a lesbian, and she felt the system of binary genders, the idea of male and female only, was a prison which limited freedom and was discriminatory in nature, and she published her ideas in this 1990 book. Gender Trouble. I'm on the wrong slide there. So there's Butler. That last slide was still Beauvoir. And Feminism and the Subversion of Identity, the fundamental work on gender ideology. And Butler's view was that the binary categories of sexual identity, male and female, are only structured through language. And for this reason, she saw that political change to language played a central role in deconstructing gender. And she aimed to shake the foundations of this gender order through what she called subversive confusion and the multiplication of gender identities. So to quote Butler, sex is an ideal construct which is forcibly materialized through time. It is not a simple fact or a static condition of the body, but a process whereby regulatory norms materialize sex and achieve this materialization through a forcible reiteration of those norms. And what this means essentially is that there are no such thing or no such things as men and women. One sex is simply a fantasy, something which we believe in because it's been repeated and forced upon us so often. Biological sex plays no role in determining our sexual identity, and gender identity is free-flowing and flexible. And you can see just those ideas of what are coming out of the students who were being interviewed. It all goes back to Butler. Now, Butler's also one of the most important practitioners of queer theory. And like the word gender, the word queer has undergone a change in meaning, where queer was once used as a deliberately offensive and aggressive term to refer to homosexuals. But it's now a verb which is used to subvert the concept of what Butler calls heterosexual normativity. So the idea that human beings just exist as male and female. Heterosexual normativity, as you might expect, is something which she deeply abhors. So summing all this up, the biological sex of individuals as man and woman is irrelevant to their gender identity. It represents what Butler calls a dictatorship of nature from which they must be free. And a person's sexual identity is determined by what they feel they are. So again, you saw that coming out in the little movie. It's flexible, it's changeable, it's diverse, if you like, it is fluid. So let's just recap on the key components of queer theory, because this is what you have to grasp to understand where this whole thing has come from and become mainstream. It's come out of radical feminism with the aim of rupturing the man-woman binary. It's a criticism at the level of words aimed at redefining words and giving them new meaning. Men and women are just myths. They're not real entities, but just social constructs. And so what we see here is that transgender people were not simply just seeking acceptance, but they were or tolerance or inclusivity. Rather, they were trying to define what normal was, to introduce a whole new way of thinking, which has now caught on and has become a new politically correct way of looking. And so queering is a verb. It describes an action which is undermining, shaking, or unsettling what's regarded as normal. So this is not an accident. It's a deliberate strategy which has been worked out from very high university level. Now, Glyn Harrison, in his excellent new book, A Better Story, God, Sex, and Human Flourishing, notes that in less than a generation, the Christian moral vision, which is the idea that human beings flourish best when sexual interests are boundaried in lifelong covenant relationships between one man and one woman, that idea has seen a profound loss of cultural power in our civilization. And he goes on in this book to explain how the sexual revolution, like all revolutions, is rooted in ideas. And there are three key ideas. So radical feminism we've looked at already. He also talks about Gnosticism as a philosophy which has been revived and is very active behind the scenes. So in the Gnostic worldview, the outer world of society and religion, and indeed the outer world of one's own body as well, are irrelevant and deceptive. What's really important is your real self, the real you, the private self. So dig deep and liberate the authentic you and become the person you want to be. So that's how Gnosticism plays into it, and then queer theory, which we've looked at as well. And Harrison goes on to suggest that this revolution in thinking is also driven by a new morality, and he references the work of the social psychologist Jonathan Haidt, who has written this fascinating book explaining why people are so divided now in their moral approaches. He says they're coming from two different perspectives. The liberal left, which puts great emphasis on care, harm, equality and fairness, and social conservatives, who are much more likely to appeal to ancient texts or tradition or ideas like the sanctity of human life to back up their ideas. So these three new ideas, the whole new morality, if you like, and then also the whole thing has been given extraordinary narrative power because it's been picked up by the media, by soaps, by film, by books, and by the internet, YouTube, and so on. And the younger generation, particularly millennials, are often learning a lot of what they learn from YouTube. So although they might be living in the same country, they're living in a completely different world in terms of the messages that they're getting and the things that they are going on to believe. Now, these ideas, they start in universities, they become current currency, a new generation of academics and intellectuals start believing them and living them out. They begin to start to impact on the mountains of culture, what we might call parliament, the media, law, the institutions, and ultimately the family as well. And the United Nations played a major role in popularizing these ideas. So at the first conference on women in Beijing in 1995, the word sex was replaced with the word gender. And then building on this, a few years later at Yogyakarta in Indonesia, there was a second UN-related conference which developed what we now know as the Yogyakarta Principles, 29 of them, and fundamental, central to that, were the two ideas of sexual orientation and gender identity. And Yogyakarta defined gender identity in the following way. You have to listen very carefully to this. Gender identity is understood to refer to each person's deeply felt internal and individual experience of gender, which may or may not correspond with the sex assigned at birth. So it's not the sex observed at birth, but the sex assigned at birth, including the personal sense of the body, which may involve a freely chosen modification of bodily appearance or function by medical, surgical, or other means. And other expressions of gender, including dress, speech, and mannerism. So you see, it's all there, the full house. So the key thing to grasp here is that gender identity is fully self-defined. And in other words, the internal experience absolutely trumps what's referred to as the arbitrary assignation of biological sex at birth. Subjective experience and belief, if you like, takes precedence over objective biological reality. And these ideas have been promulgated throughout the world and integrated throughout the education systems. Sharon James gives a very useful overview of the legal and educational changes in an essay in this book, True to Form, which came out a couple of years ago from the FIEC. And again, we can only just move through this very quickly, but let me give you a flavour. When the within the United Kingdom, the Gender Recognition Act of 2004 allowed transsexual people who are over the age of 18, who'd lived in their chosen gender for at least 2 years and had a medical certificate, to be able to apply to the Gender Recognition Panel for a gender recognition certificate. And in order to do this, they didn't have to undergo hormonal or surgical treatment at all, but they did need a medical referral. And on the basis of that, they can get a new birth certificate. Well, that's been around for 13 years in Britain. And the Equality Act made it unlawful to discriminate on basis of gender reassignment, so people had undergone that or got that certificate. And then the Same-Sex Couples Act of 2013, which legalised same-sex marriage, made it possible for a marriage to continue following one of the partners transitioning from one gender to the other, because, of course, that would then be a same-sex marriage. And then in 2016, January, this document came out from the House of Commons Women and Equalities Committee. Now, it's not law yet, but it signals future direction. And they published this report. The aim was to make changing gender a very quick and simple administrative procedure, not requiring medical authorization at all, but done solely on grounds of self-declaration. So the person says what gender they want to be, and they wanted then to make not gender reassignment the protected characteristic under the Equality Act, but actually gender identity itself. And there are moves to do that. There are private members' bills in Parliament at the moment which haven't yet passed. They also wanted to lower the age to 16. They wanted to bring in puberty blockers for young kids wanting to transition, and so on. And they suggested that we should be moving to the non-gendering of official records, which would include passports as well. Now, none of this has become law yet, but what you'll be grasping from this talk is that one of the key things here is that people are so intimidated by all this, and they don't know how to talk out against it. And what we're seeing in Parliament is very, very few of any MPs who are willing to put their heads above the parapet and challenge these new ideas, which doesn't bode well for the future. Now, what about education? Well, for example, the LGBT group Stonewall has been given government funding to combat bullying and promote tolerance, in their words. And their booklet, Getting Started, includes child-friendly definitions of gender identity and advice about preferred pronouns. The Department of Health funded a book in 2007 which simply assumed gender identity theory, titled A Guide for Young Trans People in the UK. And it told them that sex was between the legs and gender between the ears. The education group Gender Intelligence helps children understand this distinction by illustrating it with cartoons, rather like this one, which is actually from Planned Parenthood in the UK. But the idea is that there are three different centres in your body. One's for your sex, one's for your sexual orientation, and the other one is for your gender identity. And there's no one pattern that has to be followed in any particular body, so they could be all over the place. And then the charity group Gallup defines transphobia as intolerance of gender identity and goes on to explain that it's based around the wacky idea that there are two sexes. So if you're a believer in that idea, then you are transphobic. And of course, the implication there is that is how that would then impinge on hate speech and that kind of stuff, and the harm that those beliefs could cause people. So there are huge cultural, media, medical, legal and educational forces which are being used to popularize these concepts and indoctrinate even children with gender ideology. So how do we then evaluate all this? Well, we need to know our medicine. We need to know the terms and what they mean. So biological sex, determined by physical things, gender, the psychological, social and cultural aspects of being male or female, but gender identity, what your experience is of what you actually are. And I want to just touch very briefly on what I think are a number of the false claims of gender identity which can be challenged. That transgender is very common, that it's biologically fixed and determined gender, that male and female are social constructs, that some women have male brains, that transgender is not a mental health issue. I'm saying that all of these things are myths that actually aren't backed by the evidence. That gender reassignment helps mental health, I'm saying, is also a myth. That intersex is a form of transgender, that transgender is unchangeable, that people need gender reassignment procedures, and so on. Now, our time is limited, but we'll get through as many of these as we can. So first, the idea that gender dysphoria, gender transgender is very common, and the Commons Committee, we're talking about 650,000 people in the UK, that's one in every 100. In actual fact, that doesn't square with the medical literature at all, which gives figures of 1 in 10,000 or 1 in 30,000. So we're being sold a pup to some degree there. Secondly, that gender identity is something that is biologically fixed. Well, actually, we do not know what leads a person to have gender dysphoria. We know it's one of these things where probably nature and nurture, biology and upbringing both play a part, and that personal choice may have a part to play as well. So it's a little bit like the homosexuality debate, where we've been told that sexual orientation is something that is both biologically fixed and determined, and yet that is not supported by the peer-reviewed literature on the issue. The third myth, that male and female are social constructs. Well, I think that's where you were laughing the film, because we know that sex is not a social construct at all. It's determined by your chromosomes, your hormones, your gonads, and your genital sex. You can read the words there, but we all know this stuff. These are biological realities. So sex is not a social construct, it's a biological reality. You may choose to live in denial of that reality, but nonetheless, it's self-evident. The idea that men's and women's brains are different. Now, this is an interesting one. But we know that right from the very early stages that little boys and little girls are different in not just their appearance, but also in their behavior to some extent, because there is some overlap as well. And people have tried to explain this and have argued that different parts of the brain are better developed in men than in women. And you can imagine there's a lot of debate about that. But actually, more seriously, when we look at the connections within the brain, you've got a male brain on the left. You know, it's male because it's blue, and the female brain's on the right. And there are much more front-to-back, what we call parasagittal connections in men, and much more crisscross connections in women, which perhaps accounts for the reason that women are generally better at multitasking, more intuitive, men are more analytical, and so on. Which, of course, doesn't mean that a woman can't become a very capable professor of physics, and it doesn't mean that there might be a man who's capable of finding a pint of milk in the fridge, for example. But there are differences between male and female brains. So females score higher on emotional recognition tests, social sensitivity, language, and so on. And yet this is a matter of overlapping normal distribution curves. So we all know there are little girls who are very good at climbing trees, and there are boys who prefer to play with dolls, but it doesn't mean that they're the opposite sex. It just means that they're in that part of the normal distribution curve that overlaps. And this article was a classic in the New York Times, but it was written by a very strongly feminist woman, and she's making the point here: my daughter is not transgender, she's just a tomboy, for goodness sake. Get used to it. So there are differences, but there's also overlap in brains. Men certainly don't have women's brains, and vice versa. This is well worth getting or being aware of in the New Atlantist on sexuality and gender, and they look at research from a whole lot of different areas and come up with some very interesting conclusions. But all the peer-reviewed stuff that you want is in there, and the bottom line is this: the hypothesis that gender identity is an innate fixed property of human beings that's independent of biological sex, that a person might be a man trapped in a woman's body or a woman trapped in a man's body, is not supported by the scientific evidence. Next myth: transgender is just a normal variant, unless it's causing distress. Well, this is very interesting, and up until very recently, the majority of psychiatrists believe, as I've said at the beginning, that transgender or gender dysphoria, gender identity disorder, was actually a mental health disorder, that it was an element or a case of flawed thinking, if you like, categorized in what we call the body dysmorphias. And a body dysmorphia is, the definition's there, it's a mental disorder characterized by an obsessive preoccupation that one part of one's personal appearance is severely flawed and wanting exceptional measures to hide or fix it. Some people even want limbs amputated or unhappy with various parts of their body. So what it's saying is this is how it used to be seen. But I think one of the most useful analogies, although there is a slight difference, is that of anorexia nervosa. Now, you think about that, a young woman who believes, has a strong, unshakable belief that she's overweight, and so she's dieting, but it's patently obvious looking at her that she is not overweight, right? And psychiatrists certainly don't rush in and offer dietary advice, and certainly not liposuction. That would be grossly abusive. So you don't go along with the belief that the person has, which is actually not objectively correct. It's an unshakable false belief. And this is how psychiatrists used to think about this, and this is how quite a lot of us still think about it, although it's very difficult to say that now. So, you know, what is gender dysphoria? Now, and that brings you into the whole question of how you actually manage it, because until you understand what it is, you can't think and talk about the best way to manage it. And the fundamental question is this: if you get nothing else from today, get this. If a person has incongruence between their body and their identity, then you can go one of two ways with that. You could say that it's the body that's the problem, or you could say that it's the belief that's the problem. Do you see what I'm saying? So do we help them to be reconciled to their body, or do we change their body to fit their beliefs? And that is the fundamental problem that we're facing here. And the medical profession's changed its view on this in the last 10 years. It is a well-established fact, no one disputes this, that transgender people do suffer from a much higher level of other mental health problems. This is indisputable in the medical literature. So the argument is about why. And as you can imagine, there are different narratives. There are some who say, well, it's because perhaps gender dysphoria is a mental health problem in itself that is therefore associated with these things. Or the other view is to say, well, it's because people who are transgender are so badly persecuted that they want that they suffer depression, anxiety, and want to kill themselves. But the figures and the range of disorders are absolutely extraordinary, as you can see here. In the US, suicide attempts among trans men, almost half have attempted suicide, and trans women are roughly 10 times the rate found in the overall population. In Ontario, 18 times that of the general population. And we now know that there is also an association with autism and gender dysphoria in children. New research starting to come out. The jury's still out, but this is even The Guardian saying this and publishing this research now, which tells you that it is not possible anymore to doubt it. Another thing you'll hear, that intersex and transgender are the same thing, that intersex is just part of the whole transgender thing. That also is a myth. Now, there are a whole lot of conditions of what we know as intersex. We've recognized them as doctors for many, many decades. And in intersex, there is an abnormality in either the chromosomes or in the hormones or in the internal gonadal structures, the ovaries and testes, or in the external genitalia, which is due to a physical, biochemical, hormonal, or structural abnormality. That's what intersex is. And there are lots of different diagnoses you can see, and there are well-constructed treatment pathways for each one in terms of how you manage kids with these conditions. So you can get women who are masculinized because they're producing male hormones. You can get the reverse with men and so on. This is totally and utterly different from transgender, where all these things are normal. So don't be fooled into by people who want to conflate the two. Gender dysphoria treatments. The idea that that transgender people are fixed and will never change is just simply not borne out by the evidence. So 50% of all adults who start gender reassignment treatment never finish it. And for children, it is often recognized simply as a passing phase, that they'll go through a point of incongruence, if you like, during their early life, but they do not persist. And the interesting points that there as well, most gender dysphoria doesn't resolve with psychological treatment, so it can be very difficult to treat. But for 25% of people, the outcome of surgery is not positive either. And when I was training in surgery, I worked with a urologist who did all the gender reassignment surgery in New Zealand. I didn't help him, he did it in the private hospital, but his patients used to come in to the public hospital with complications, and I used to have to look after them. And he stopped doing it simply because of the results, that they were not good. And the more he followed it on, the more he came to doubt the worth of what he was doing, and eventually came out of the practice altogether. Now, I think time has caught up with us, and I just mentioned briefly, obviously, we could talk a lot about the societal effects that transgender has, bathrooms, sports teams, classroom confusion among children, and so on, but now we're starting to see the discrimination cases and the pressures on health professionals to conform. And then we haven't got time to look at the medical effects, but it's another myth that gender reassignment involving hormones and surgery is safe medically.
For the past half hour, you've been listening to the Christian War Room with host Michael Schonborn. For more information on how you can participate or find out more about the Christian War Room, simply go to christianwarroom.com. That's christianwarroom.com.